You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I'm Terry Fisher. Welcome to the discussion and celebration of John Palfrey's new book, Intellectual Property Strategy. A few logistical matters before we begin. There are books to be purchased, if you have not already obtained one, at a desk outside of the classroom, and right there inside the classroom. Right. And I think John will be available for signing, both physical copies, and the turns out to be possible to sign the iPad version as well, though exactly how I don't know.
That's the exciting part, that we're saving that up.
Okay. More mundane technology, this session will be videotaped, although not webcast, but there's a chance that the videotape will be broadly disseminated, so if you don't for any reason want your comments or questions recorded, you need to tell one of us and they will be edited out of the tape. Last logistical matter is there is a reception. This one is outside the classroom just after the event. Okay, so a few words by way of substantive introduction. This book is in several respects highly innovative. So first, it bridges theory and practice in a way that's unusual among legal scholarship. It is intended primarily for non-legal audiences, but it draws quite heavily, if you're aware of the background, upon the academic literature concerning intellectual property. It's one of its great accomplishments, is achieving that bridge. Second non-traditional dimension of the book is that it's written in hypertext form. So there is a spine that carries the substantive argument that appears in the book proper, but from that spine are hung many interviews, case studies, other material that one can explore to fill out the argument, examine it in more detail. And the third of the innovative features, as John's already emphasized, is that it comes with a cool iPad app, although I assume that in keeping with the argument of the book, a Android-compatible app is close behind.
Okay.
So, in all those respects, it's a genuinely novel book. But in another respect, it's quite traditional. The principal virtues of the argument are balance and wisdom. It contends convincingly that business people currently are insufficiently attentive to the myriad ways in which intellectual property rights can be acquired and then deployed. And it offers measured, thoughtful, wise advice to them about the optimal techniques to use under different circumstances. So in substance, not form, is the kind of book you would expect from a senior faculty member looking back over quite an array of examples and quite a substantial body of literature and offering thoughtful guidance. This combination of extreme innovation on the one hand and traditional values and virtues on the other is characteristic of John. That very distinctive combination of traits has enabled him to do extraordinary things in many different settings here at Harvard. Closest to my own knowledge, it made him an extraordinary executive director of the Berkman Center it enabled him to reshape the Harvard Law School library. It has infused his teaching in the law school and the college, and to his credit in the extension school. And finally, it has enabled him successfully to launch the Digital Public Library of America. It's probably the most grand experiment in library science ever undertaken in the United States. Unfortunately for our purposes, but fortunately for the world's, John's going to be leaving Harvard, not completely, but for the most part, at the end of this academic year. As most of you, I think, know, he will be taking up a position as the head of school at the Andover Academy as of, I think, July. He will continue to carry on in some of the leadership positions he already carved out for himself, most importantly, as a director of the Berkman Center and as the leader of the Digital Public Library of America. But his main base from here on, for the next several years at least, will not be at Harvard. He'll be at Andover. That, as I say, is our loss, but clearly Andover's gain. And more broadly, John plans to use this strong platform to explore the ways in which secondary school education could be and should not be informed by digital technology. So almost certainly he will emerge from his next post having reshaped not just the curriculum of Andover, but the curriculum of the secondary schools throughout the United States. So I'm quite confident, on the basis of what he's done already in the many venues in which I've seen him, he will be fully successful in this new project. So I'd like you to join me first in welcoming John and then wishing him well in his new venture.
Terry, thank you. And thank you, all of you, for coming out tonight to talk about intellectual property strategy. This is a treat to be with you, and I'm not sure I'll ever let you introduce me again, Terry. That was very nice and too much. So tonight, I thought we would talk both, as Terry suggested, about substance and about form. So we're going to spend the first part of the evening talking about the topic of intellectual property strategy and the argument in this little book. And I brought some friends to help, which I'm very grateful for. Part of the idea here is about crowdsourcing, and some people will help make this case, and maybe I'll even cold call on a few people who will also help make this case along the way. But I also want to talk a bit about the future of the book itself and the form that we love, and to talk about how we might think broadly about libraries and information and knowledge in the context of these changes. And we have a few things to show you in the context of this book that I think are just gestures toward a future that I hope will be incredibly rich and exciting. Okay, so I'm going to make in very short form the core of the argument of this book. I will highlight the fact that it's part of a new series by MIT Press called the Central Knowledge Series, which means it's really short and easy to read and so forth. So I'm going to give you the gist of it, but it's meant in a way to be read on an airplane between the East Coast and the West Coast, or the West Coast and the East Coast of the United States. So
it's like intellectual property for smarties.
See. Not quite sure how to respond to that, Jonathan. yeah, I guess it is, right? Yeah, that's great. A new series idea for Alan Farren. Right. Okay, so let me start with the core of this idea, and then we'll build some concentric circles around it. And then with respect to the substance of the book, I want to do the form of the book, I want to do the same thing, talk about the core form of it in this traditional-looking codex thing, and build out toward other forms. So the basic idea, as Terry put it, was to make an argument actually for people who are running organizations. The idea, in a way contrary to the Berkman tradition of scholarship, is actually to take the law as it is, to start not from the perspective of a law reformer or someone who wishes to make the case for changes in law, but to say actually let's imagine how you might think about intellectual property strategy without having to make any changes. In fact, knowing that the law is changing very quickly, one of the key background points. And so this is written toward CEOs of nonprofits or of for-profit organizations. And the basic claim is the way in which you have been taught through traditional mantra in intellectual property is wrong. The original idea is the idea of IP as a sword and a shield. So the sword is to skewer your opponent, to get them with your IP, or as a shield, something to protect you from their swords, to evoke the battlefield. And the basic idea of this book is, in fact, to make a different analogy as the core argument for intellectual property strategy, to think about it as a flexible asset class, something that you can use as the CEO or the leader of an organization to fulfill whatever your mission is. And in this case, your mission might be profit maximization. That's a perfectly appropriate, maybe in fact legally necessary in some cases, goal for profits. On the other hand, to say if you're a nonprofit, if you're running a library or a museum, you too can use intellectual property, not in the sword and shield way, but as a way to maximize your mission. I'll get to that in a second. So that's a very, very simple initial claim of the book. And the way, as Terry mentioned, that I make this set of arguments is through case studies, to look at lots of different examples where companies and others have used intellectual property flexibly and creatively to pursue their goals that are not the standard kind of litigation and defense matter. Now, it's not to say that the sword and the shield doesn't ever attach. Sometimes, clearly, people need shields from intellectual property, and plainly, people use intellectual property as a sword sometimes. So those are part of the set of opportunities you have with IP. My argument is just that you should expand that and see it much more broadly. And at the core of this book is an argument that strategies toward openness are a good thing. Initially, I make the claim that they're a good thing for your business and for your nonprofit. Also, at the end of the book, I admit that I think that they're a good thing for society, too. But that's not the basic premise. Okay, three of the examples and why I think they matter, and then I'm going to call on some friends for help. So the first example is a really straightforward one, familiar, I think, to many people, but it's the fight over smartphones. We see the platform for computing changing very rapidly from one that is based on the PC and one to mobile phones. Apple predicts that by next year, more people will access the web using a mobile device than from a standalone device like this kind of thing. So the importance, obviously, of this as a delivery device has only gone up. And if you look back in terms of how Apple approached its smartphone development, one of the things they did back in 2007 was they took a license. They took a license from a company called InterDigital for about $20 million, and that bought them access to the rights to use something like 200 patents that would allow them to develop the iPhone over a period of years. At roughly the same time along the way, a company called RIM that makes the BlackBerry took a similar license from this same company, which was a patent-holding company, InterDigital. Fast forward a few years, Samsung decides that they want to compete with Apple and with RIM in the smartphone business and to develop things with the Android platform. And for whatever reason, and I don't know the reason, they didn't come to an agreement with InterDigital to license these patents, and they ended up paying what is estimated between $400 and $500 million to settle a lawsuit from InterDigital and to be able to do roughly the same thing. So why does this matter? It's a very simple business argument that paying attention to this upfront can save you a lot of money. It also makes it possible at all. And I think one of the reasons this example is important is also to think about our attitude toward innovation broadly. It's an interesting question as to whether or not we want startups in the United States to be able to compete in this market, right? And thinking about the barriers to entry that we have established with respect to the entry cost of getting these series of licenses, which might in fact require thousands of patents to be licensed in to start competing in this particular marketplace. So there are many ways to see this first example, but the basic point is that IP is an asset class and you ought to see it more flexibly, and having a strategy for it is crucial. And from a public policy perspective, even if you don't care who has to pay more or less in order to develop these things, we ought to care. We ought to care what the effects of these policies are and these strategies are on innovation broadly in the United States. And I think another topic we could get into is how different states around the world have thought about innovation and IP policy and how that might affect competitiveness and globalization. So that's kind of the very basic first argument, which is IP is an asset class and having a strategy in it matters, both for an individual firm and more broadly for innovation. Okay, second example. Terry mentioned this slightly unorthodox career move that I'm making to go work at a secondary school, which I have deeply mixed feelings about. I love it here, and I love all of you and doing this work, and I look forward to continuing to doing the research. But I'm also very excited to focus on the questions of secondary education and to look into the ways in which the lives of young people are changing along many, many dimensions with respect to the mediation of technology. And one could talk about this in the context of privacy and bullying, lots of important things. But in the context of this book, I actually think there's an argument to be made that one of the reasons that intellectual property strategy matters is because the attitudes of young people toward intellectual property are clearly changing so rapidly. One of the things we've been doing at the Berkman Center through our youth and media project is interviewing kids. We're, for a second time in the field, my friend Urs Gasser, who's somewhere in cyberspace, I think perhaps even in Turkey, presenting to the parliament in Ankara about these very topics right now, and I and Sandra Cortese and others are interviewing kids. And once again, we are finding, as we did several years ago in working on a book called Born Digital, the kids really do have an attitude toward intellectual property that is changing very quickly. And it's not at all surprising that there is a resistance to strong arguments about strong forms of intellectual property and restrictions on the ability to use, particularly in the context of learning, intellectual property of others. We can go much further down this argument. Plainly, Larry's book on Remix is a really strong example for why this matters. But I see the changing social norms of kids and technology, good and bad in many respects, which bear on IP, as an extremely important lesson for businesses anywhere in the information business. And by that, I also mean institutions like Harvard or institutions like Andover, that thinking about the fact that we are in information businesses, we're in knowledge businesses, and actually have to think about how we are strategically presenting what we have. How much are we enforcing scarcity, the way in which we restrict the flow of information and the extent to which our knowledge is shared broadly in order to privilege those who have come here for residential education, and how much, as MIT has done with OpenCourseWare and other broadly open strategies, we in fact are looking toward the spread of knowledge and the spread of information in ways that will benefit the world at large and maybe also benefit our kids who are here. So I think that the changing social norms among kids opens up lots of different avenues when we think about the institutional posture toward intellectual property. And this is a second big claim that I make in the book, which is intellectual property strategy should be flexible over time, that plainly having a one-size-fits-all approach that is geared toward a previous iteration of history doesn't make a lot of sense, and that the possibilities of the web and the possibilities of digital media broadly are very important to rethink at this very moment. And I'm excited to work on this both here and at Andover. Okay, third argument why IP strategy matters relates to libraries. I'm delighted to see so many of my colleagues here from the Harvard Libraries and the project on the Digital Public Library of America. And I think that the notion of taking information and spreading it as broadly as we can, as well as keeping it, preserving it in many respects for a particular community, is an important way to see intellectual property strategy. So one of the things that we ask ourselves here at the Harvard Library, Terry Fisher and I are on the Harvard Library Board, is to what extent should we be privileging the uses of information here on our Harvard campus for those who pay tuition here or those who are paid to work here? And how much should we be emphasizing the public good? How much should we be looking to share what we have more broadly with the world? And how do we find a happy medium between these potentially conflicting goals? And I think our initial instinct is, the right answer is, where it serves both is our sweet spot, right? Where we can serve the immediate needs of our community and where it also is something that we're sharing broadly is a good thing. But I think we may have to work harder than that particular viewpoint. That's a wonderful starting point, and I think we should emphasize it. But what happens when these two things come in conflict? What happens when we have to think hard about choices between serving somebody immediately here and the digitization and contextualization, curation of materials to go into something like the Digital Public Library of America? When that becomes a trade-off, how do we make that decision? I think that's a really good, hard question of intellectual property strategy for an institution like Harvard, and frankly, should be for any library in the world that has the ability to share its materials uniquely. That might be true in Torino. It might be true in Ankara, where Ursu is right now, and it's something that I think we're going to have to grapple with. That's the kind of question of intellectual property strategy that I think we ought to be emphasizing. All right, so I'm going to pause there. Those are three arguments for why IP strategy matters, but I'm really grateful to be joined by several of my colleagues who have helped in the development of this book and this argument, and I was hoping that I might turn to some of you to help make arguments, either pro or contra, in fact, to the views in this book. I would be in favor of challenges to the argument I make, but certainly amplification as well. And Jonathan, since you're sitting there, and I think Larry may have nominated you to go first, Jonathan Zintrin, would you give us some examples for why IP strategy matters, and maybe even some contradictions of what I've said?
Sure. Larry will get his. But I always like to open my comments with a threat, usually a lateral threat. One question I had was, it kind of harkens back to, for people in our line of work, an age-old debate between Richard Stallman and Eric Raymond. Stallman says, you may have the ability through law, through technology, through some means, to bottle up that which otherwise could be freely copyable, but you shouldn't. It's wrong. It's unethical. And Eric Raymond says, that may well be true, but that's no way to speak to the kinds of firms that have the property in question, or unproperty as it may be. He says, better to make the case that there will be all sorts of returns in being open, and flexible is but one click away from open, in one's strategies. And I gather you're certainly on board with Raymond's way of looking at things, except maybe open isn't always, it's not a panacea, but that's where the surprises lie. The default rule is let's bottle it up, and particularly within a university environment, that seems a bad default rule, and one that I know to this day, it'll be interesting to see what Andover finds, or what you find at Andover, the defaults here are surprisingly still pegged towards defense and closed and stuff like that. I remember actually I wrote a tiny little mini book called Technological Complements to Copyright.
It has that great lock on the cover, right?
And it has it on the cover of it is an old-fashioned book with a chain on it from the times when books had chains, so they wouldn't, right. It's before they had the electronic devices and the police forces to chase you as you took it out of the monastery. And I wanted to get a picture of such a book for the cover of my book about lockdown books. And went to the Harvard Library. There's a special library for books with chains on them. And I was like, hi, I'd like a book with a chain on, just a photo of it. And they were like, you're not allowed. And I was like, well, that's ironic. Surely it's out of copyright by now, even with Mary Bono and friends. And they're like, that's right. We're just keeping you away from it so that you can't take a picture of it, because the flash could cause it to disintegrate. And I said, I won't use a flash. And I basically
went
in.
There may be some librarians who actually have a good answer to that, Jonathan.
I'm sure. I went to that. I said, well, they said, we do have a solution for you, though. You can pay us $50, and somebody else will take a picture of the book, and then you can have the picture. I said, all right, that sounds fine
to
me.
It's a good IP strategy right
Except that the picture is under copyright, because there's artistic value in the picture, even though the thing it's a picture of is in the public domain. So that's a great example of just, possession being 9/10 of jerkiness. And I forget how I ultimately solved it. I hope I didn't just steal their picture.
So they may well be sitting right here.
If so, all I have to do is wait 90 more years, and it'll be fine, unless it gets retroactively extended more. But all of this is a way to say our defaults so often tend towards close, and you ask us, both in the book and in your opening, for whatever organization we're with, to ask ourselves, what do we stand for, what are our values, what are we trying to do here, and maybe what are we trying to do here is a nice bridge between Stallman and Raymond, because that's a way of trying to get some sense of mission and ethics into it, not just what will sell the most X, what will get us the best return.
I think that's super helpful. And The argument, I think, may be different for a for-profit or a non-profit, so I'm accepting the fact that there may be instances in which the mission of the organization really is toward, you know, enforcing scarcity and so forth, and I think in different fields that may well be true. I think that's very rarely true in the kinds of non-profits that we work in, and Chapter 7 of this book is the special case of the non-profit. And the argument there is to say, think about your mission, what it really is, and then map your IP strategy to that. So lots of places that seek to, in essence, profit maximize within a nonprofit, it seems to me, may be missing the fact that you can gain hugely from sharing the materials and so
just
forth.
Just say, too, it calls to mind just that moment when at the Berkman Center over 10 years ago, we sought to teach online lecture and discussion series. Originally, we called them cyber seminars, and then the provost got wind of it and said that we couldn't do that because then people would be walking around the world saying, I'm taking a class at Harvard. You know, that we just, that can't be. You can't have 100,000 people walking around the world saying something like, I'm taking a class at Stanford on AI. There's so many people taking that Stanford AI class right now, I think they're about to become self-aware. So it was just funny to see the attitude then was, you can't do it. And then it became flexibly, well, so long as you call it online lecture and discussion series so that no one knows what the hell it is, then it would be okay because people will walk around the world confused. And that turned out to be the end. I remember saying, the provost was actually in his office, he was like, well, it's not like you know, people can just take this rug. I was like, well, that's a powerful argument, but this rug is made of straw men. You know, think about like the Fog Art Museum. It's not like we charge people to just come look at the paintings. He was like, blink, blink, we charge people to come look at the painting. So I was like, I'm out of here.
Well, we have a new provost who it seems very sympathetic and actually came from Stanford and is highly aware of this AI class. But I actually think this is a great challenge for what is Harvard going to be in the next several decades. And I hope one thing is much more open with respect to the teaching and learning that we do here in terms of sharing it broadly. And my sense is it's going to become a competitive issue for us. A competitive issue against Stanford, it's a competitive issue against the Khan Academy, it's going to be a competitive issue against some, you know, outfit in another part of the world. And I think you can think about it from our mission is sharing knowledge, or we can think about it as this actually might get in the way of Harvard being whatever Harvard ought to be in a digital era. And I'm actually, the argument of this book is really the latter, not so much just the former.
And one tiny question, just to finish this riff together on, is what should our policy be and what options should there be for our students who do work? Should we compel them, if you're doing work for this class, it must be released free on the web? Should it
be
their choice?
So like getting an NIH grant or something, right.
Right.
No, I think our claim to open access at Harvard, which we've done with scholarship, is one of the things I'm most proud of. Stuart Schieber here, who's Terry and others who deserve tons of credit for this, I think this is one of the best things we've done, and it should be the thin end of the wedge in lots of ways. So in the library context, we should make our metadata more freely available. In the context of our students, I think we could require them to pay forward more effectively some of what happens. So I absolutely agree. That's the starting point, I think, strategically for the university in truly building the next campus of Harvard in cyberspace, which I think we should. Professor Lessig, you get second dibs.
So I am extremely supportive of the idea, how do we take existing IP and make it work? Obviously that...
What have we done about it?
Only 10 years of service on
right.
that topic.
So obviously that was the motivation behind Creative Commons, and I think this is a wonderful, well, not that, this is, you know, a copy
not so
of a
much.
Book with a lock, but your book is extraordinarily important in advancing that. But I think it's one way to think about the problem is the way in which IP law gets used to help communities conform to their ex-ante expectations of what they're there for, and the advantage that might come from helping the communities to conform to what their ex-ante expectations are there for. So is Yochai here?
Yochai is away, unfortunately.
Okay,
but
so I'm going to
channel
will be in
Yochai. Both shortly.
Okay,
yeah,
so
yeah,
but I'll yeah. channel a little bit of Yochai. So if we think about, you know, we could imperialistically impose the model of business model on everybody. So we think about the business model of lots of different communities. Obviously, some are commercial, but some are not commercial. Some communities or people just want to get together and share and create And when they want to get together and share and create, they need to be able to rely on the idea that what they're doing together is sharing and creating in this non-commercial way. IP sometimes helps them do that, or at least IP deployed in a certain way. So one of the motivations behind the relatively crude license we call the Creative Commons non-commercial license was to give people in such a context a simple way to be able to signal to each other that when I'm doing stuff like this, we're doing it for non-commercial purposes, I'm happy you do whatever you want with my stuff for non-commercial purposes, but if you want to take my photo from Flickr and use it on the cover of your next album from Sony, you need to come and talk to me, because that's outside of the norms of this community. And so that was a way of deploying IP so that it could reinforce the community. And that led to the next step, which was businesses that recognized if they wanted to be able to leverage those communities, they needed to be able to respect the norms of that community, and these licenses became tools to enable them to respect the norms of those communities. And so Flickr is an example of a company which very early on recognized they wanted people inside the Flickr community to feel like they could share all sorts of images and information, and using Creative Commons licenses to do that was a simple way to signal that kind of norm. What's striking to me, following on this conversation Jonathan initiated about the academic community, is that, this is a point that Jamie Boyle, who's always here in some form, makes about where we've seen progress in liberalizing content. He said, if 20 years ago you had sat down and you said, of all the communities out there, which ones do you think would be most progressive in figuring out how to liberalize IP? You know, education, the academy, science, music, film, you know, and if you ordered it like that 20 years ago, you would have said, of course, education, right, and the academy, they'd be right at the top, science right at the top, and musicians and photographers and filmmakers, they'd be right at the bottom. But in fact, we've seen exactly the opposite, right? We've seen some of the most innovative, creative stuff coming from some of the people you would expect are least likely to be innovative, and the academy education being places where there's still a lot of work to be done. So in the academy context, IP needs to be deployed much more forcefully and vigorously, especially by the administrations, to drive us towards the norms of the community that we all expect we're going to have. So scientists write scientific journals, articles that get published in scientific journals that are themselves protected by such extreme restrictions of IP that basically all of us inside of our elite universities are able to access them freely. But people outside of elite American universities or elite universities around the world are blocked from their ability to access this because we, the creators, don't take enough responsibility for our creativity to insist that the creativity exist out there in a form consistent with our values. Nobody's, you don't have to criticize the publishers, they're just doing their business. The point is, we are the creators, and we should be in the business of saying our creativity ought to be freely accessible where that's consistent with our, quote, business model, which for many of us is the business model of the academy, of the Enlightenment, of what we thought we were supposed to do. So I think that to the extent that we can neutralize the politics of, like, let's kill IP or not, which seems to be the tenor of too much of the debate, and instead focus on the utility of ways to deploy IP to advance different models of how we want to create and share, that's big progress, and this is a contribution, especially if it can lead us back to this question of why we academics aren't more sharing in our forms of creativity. So congratulations.
I love it. Thank you. That's so helpful. I thought of you, Larry, this weekend. I think a lot of people got probably this a link to this video. I don't know if you've seen this. Let's see if I can do it. Hold on. Maybe not.
Thank you.
These guys are the best right here. You get the point, but the idea the idea of community norms expressed through creative IP. This was a student project at a little town in Alaska, no doubt violating somebody's IP. I suspect they didn't exactly license that, nor did I, for doing that. But it seems to me this idea of expression of community norms through intellectual property strategy is totally the right premise, so thank you. Bill Malone.
So, congratulations. There's a lot to love about this book. I'd like to be contrarian and critical and say some bad things, but I can't. So, picking out a couple of the things I think are most noteworthy to really focus on. One goes back to the words you chose to start, which are you were trying to take a balanced, thoughtful, and reasonable approach to this topic. And to me, that really jumps out, that you have consciously and successfully avoided a knee-jerk reaction here, either in rejecting the sword and shield metaphor of let's be proprietary and always lock it up, but also not automatically assuming the nice Berkman open all the time is always good approach, that requires thought, it requires really thinking about the strategy and the ultimate goals. Sometimes will lead to more of one, sometimes more of the other. I think that's that call for being really thoughtful in how we approach it is actually quite important, particularly for the practical audience to which you intend it. The other thing I was really very happy to see is the inclusion of a specific section on the case of nonprofits and the importance of nonprofits. And again, there it's very easy to sort of have a knee-jerk reaction and say, well, they're nonprofits, they're meant to do good, so of course they should be open. And I think largely that's the case, but isn't necessarily the case without thought. And often that thought can be quite revealing. A couple of quick examples that I'm aware of that for me at least really helped make that point. A few years ago, the cyber law clinic that I run worked with the Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum here in Boston. As many of you know, they have this wonderful Sunday concert series where they bring in fabulous musicians, perform this amazing classical music in their beautiful tapestry room, just these amazing events. The room's fairly small, doesn't hold that many people, only so many people can enjoy it, but they record them. And they had been sitting on a bigger and bigger stockpile of these fabulous recordings for years, and they wanted to somehow bring them to the world. And they had tried a time or two in the past to put them on CD and sell them in the gift shop, and they had sold 50 or 100, not really a lot of impact. And they had the idea of releasing them online as podcasts, downloadable podcasts, and they had the even better idea of, rather than locking them up under some kind of proprietary license, of putting a Creative Commons license on them, of saying, take this music, share it, you know, give it to your friends, pass it on to people. And they thought through and very carefully recognized that not just because it was sort of they were a museum and it was the right thing to do, but for very practical reasons of what they wanted to accomplish, branding of the museum, really sort of drawing in a bigger audience to them, both to see the museum and to see the concerts, and so on. This was a much more effective strategy. Within the first 2 years of this series called The Concert, they had over 1 million downloads of the podcast recordings, far more than they could ever have gotten any other way. And the benefit to the museum and all these other ways was vastly larger than they could ever have hoped for. So it was a great example of somebody really thinking through this carefully and approaching it for the right reasons. Another example you cite in the book is, what do charitable foundations, the people who fund so much nonprofit work, whether it's science, arts, music, literature, what approach do they take to intellectual property and copyright? And so a couple of years ago at Berkman, we did a study of how foundations deal with these issues and what their practices are. And it turns out, for the most part, they don't really think about it. You know, just the copyright is held in default, usually by the creator who gets the money, and usually not much happens, but it sits there locked up. And a few very thoughtful, foresighted foundations have figured out that if they use Creative Commons licenses, and perhaps even require, or at least encourage, their grantees to use open licenses, whether Creative Commons for content or the GPL or something open for software, that they actually enhance their overall mission a great deal. They increase the spread of those works. They increase the number of people who see them. They make it easier for other people to build on them and actually create and innovate on top of the innovation. So the actual reach and impact of what they do is far greater. And yet our study also revealed that there are cases and circumstances and contexts where an open approach perhaps isn't best. Maybe it's protecting indigenous traditional knowledge from exploitation. Maybe it's certain rare cases where sustainability, economic sustainability, is actually important, and that relies on being able to sell something in a way that might be harder. But it was thoughtful. It was at least provided some tools for thinking about this in a different way and not just having a default knee-jerk reaction toward, I don't know, we lock it up, or, oh, of course it should be open. And I commend you on your book sort of really working through that and offering guidance to people in business who are probably prone to take much more of a knee-jerk reaction.
That's so nice. Thank you. I think two things, Phil, that your examples raise. There are some requirements for being able to do this kind of thing. I think one is the platform that things like Creative Commons licenses make possible, right? So this is, I think, Jonathan's generativity in a sense, that you actually need some of these things to build on. The other is good lawyers, right, and people to be advisors who know how to deploy them, as your clinic does. So to Sonia and all the students here from the Harvard Law School, and Ryan, a graduate, and so forth, I think it's really important to recognize the importance of training lawyers in these particular flexible approaches that you're doing in the clinic, so thank you. So we have a professor from a business school here, actually, in Eric Von Hippel, our colleague from the Sloan School at MIT. Erica, you have done simply the most important work, I think, in this field, certainly from the business perspective, and have helped us to see different forms of innovation in ways that were unexpected. You're a huge huge inspiration to me, and I know everybody in the Berkman community. So I wonder if you might just help us see the importance of IP strategy in the context of the kinds of innovation that you study.
Well, I think you invite me into teacher classes in part for entertainment value, because
that's
I'm rather radical about the whole thing. I mean, you know, the traditional thought about, you know, IP and specifically patents being to promote progress in science and useful arts. As you know, there's a lot of research recently saying that, really, when you add up the costs of patents versus the benefits of patents, it's not in the least clear that they promote it. And fundamental to that, getting even sort of more stronger argument in current days, is really the fact that invention is getting cheaper and cheaper. The tools to invent are cheaper. It's no longer, I mean, people always come up with this sort of corner case of, well, my God, you know, pharmaceuticals, you know, you'd never get any drugs. You would not live forever. It'd be horrible.
We're going to put that to Mr. Fisher after you.
Yeah. And then you look and you sort of say, well, wait a minute now. All these sort of people making illegal drugs are doing it in the bathtub over a weekend.
How do you know that?
You know, when we... Well, I sent a student out to actually take a look. And they said, well, if we told you, we'd have to kill you. And they had not a humorous glint in their eyes. So I thought, well, this is not a good thing to send a student out to. But, I mean, in fact, it's so in many areas that innovation is getting cheaper and cheaper. So what on earth are we doing this for? Now, if somebody were really to add up the cost, I'm not talking about the patent side of things, the cost of the whole infrastructure, the cost of the whole education that you are now getting in IP, and offset it against the benefit, it might be rather a difficult argument to make. So I'm actually of the feeling that that as innovation gets cheaper and cheaper, users can do it, it's democratized, and in a way, the whole infrastructure it'll be below the radar. You know, there's no way you can catch them. So in a sense, what we've got here is a free zone, you know, where people can do as they please, and you know, the whole machinery can't get you. And I think that's actually a good thing. And I will tell you about something about regulatory matters in this case. Sorry, it's not in. We just last week had a meeting with the FDA and with patients and so on who were innovating on their own. And one of them was that people were finding that that there were ways to solve Crohn's disease and so on, and to do it by getting these sort of parasites that you get infected. They found it in Africa. There are very few people who get Crohn's disease and various other autoimmune disease. They connected it up with the fact that they have parasites there that also challenge the immune system. And the FDA was saying, yeah, you know, somebody might do a trial someday. You just have to wait. And the users were going out, traveling to Africa, buying the eggs of these parasites and passing them around with friendly notes saying, you know, hey, 15 years is my life, you know? And so I really think that what will happen here is that the infrastructure of IP may slowly adjust, but really underneath it, what is happening is new modes of behavior, as you mentioned with respect to your book and how children now feel. New modes of behavior are going to emerge that will represent a strikingly different alternative that will at some point be available for reification and thinking about. So that's my sort of cheerful thought.
Amazing, amazing. Seems like that's actually a perfect segue to Mr. Fisher here in the context of drugs. I don't know, Terry, if you're willing to help make that bridge conceptually of how intellectual property strategy is relevant to your current work as well. Or if you had a different
example. By the way, Terry invented an ice axe. And gave it away.
That's true.
May I mention?
I find myself in the odd position of being within the spectrum on which your book is located, I guess in the conservative position. So on the particular front that you just mentioned, although it's certainly true that there are interesting opportunities both for pharmaceutical innovation and even more so clinical or quasi-clinical testing that involve bottom-up communities collaborating, for the most part, it remains true in, as Eric says, the corner case, that some degree of exclusivity is necessary to pay the approximately $800 million cost of generating a new beneficial pharmaceutical product. Now, that's not to say that the patent system with respect to pharmaceutical products is working well. It's not. It's working quite badly. There are serious biases in how it's administered, most importantly against vaccines, which is true throughout the world, and then most grimly, in my view, that against the development of drugs that benefit people with contagious diseases in developing countries. So we currently tolerate approximately 9 million deaths per year from diseases that we have the technological capacity to solve. It's an outrage. But the way to address the outrage is not to make the AIDS drugs in bathtubs. It's just not.
You can have the mic next, Eric. I can tell. He's chomping at the bit.
So let me address briefly, again, from the, I guess, middle of the spectrum.
You almost said right.
Here.
I could see the R forming.
Yeah, I just couldn't handle it. Your original question, why does intellectual property matter? So for the past 4 years, I've been working on a course currently with Felix Oberholzer on the business school on intellectual property and business strategy, and you've taught in it, and so has Jonathan. Recently, the World Intellectual Property Organization asked us to do it in developing countries. And so we've
got some signs from back saying you might need to lean into the mic more or use that one.
Okay, although I'm not entirely sure I want this one broadcast.
I see, I see. Note to self, we'll edit later. Yeah.
So I just got back from Singapore offering the same course there, and we're going to be offering it in Chile in March. Among the many things that's been quite remarkable about this experience is the discovery of how uneven is the appreciation of the range of options that you so effectively chronicle in your book concerning the deployment of intellectual property. There are, at one extreme, really sophisticated people. Man last week, who's the CIPO? Now, this is a new title in organizations. CIPO. CIPO is Chief Intellectual Property Officer. You know, okay, they're the CIPO of a heavy machinery.
It's like grade inflation. They have to have a C-level thing for everything.
Yeah, absolutely, right. And a single line report to the CEO seems to be the mark of status. As I say, the CIPO of a heavy machinery company in northern India was unbelievably sophisticated in his calculations. The opposite extreme, CEOs of international pharmaceutical firms, to return to this example, can be remarkably crude. Honing their awareness of the array of options is more of a challenge than I thought and is more important than I thought. Okay, now, last comment, swinging around a little bit to the other side of the ledger. One of the zones in which they are least aware, it seems, is opportunities for collaboration with respect to intellectual property. So how to extract monopoly rents, they may not be really sophisticated in the techniques of differential pricing, but they get the basic idea of how to squeeze out of the lemon as much juice as possible. It's the other stuff that's less clear cut, how to collaborate with competitors in growing a market without raising excessive barriers to entry and violating the antitrust laws, how to collaborate with customers, which is your brilliant innovation, how to collaborate with the developers of complements, a strategy that Apple stumbles upon late in its corporate career. These are all things that are sort of eye-opening to a surprisingly large number of senior executives in companies. So in this one respect, I have to confess a change of heart, which is when we had an early conversation about the normative implications of your work, an exchange in person and in print, I expressed some doubt concerning the practical application of one of your major claims, namely that if you just tell people about the benefits of this new strategy, they'll change their ways. To which my general thought was, no, they must be aware of this option, they're just not exercising it right now. You have to make them change their ways through law reform. Yeah. I'm not so clear that's correct. You may be right on this front, that they seem remarkably ignorant of the opportunities that you chronicle in your books, and therefore enterprises, of the sort exemplified by this thing, alerting people to strategies that enable them to do well while doing good, is really socially constructive.
Fabulous. Eric von Hippel, before I'll take a few questions, but I figured you might want to respond to some of the earlier claims there.
I'm such a huge fan of Terry, and I have to tell you the story.
Keep the disagreement of the, going. It's
no,
fun.
No. Well, I'll get to that, but I have to tell you the story of the ice axe. So I went out to Terry's house for dinner, and this was the first time, and you were there, I think, Jay-Z, and we were sitting there and talking about user innovation and so forth, and he went down to the basement and came up waving this axe. And I thought, you know, this is a dinner I should have skipped. You know? But it turned out what he was doing was he had, as a user innovator, figured out a novel application or need for an ice axe sort of dangling. Oh, he climbs ice cliffs. I can't believe it. I mean, anyway. So you might just parenthetically want to mention what this was, this epiphany you had is hanging over a gorge. Would you rather not?
The amazing Mr. Fisher. Come on.
You've been outed as a user innovator. So.
As long as I've been outed, I better be get the facts straight, which is I was a minor member of a community that was engaged in a process of experimenting. I surely was not the pioneer in this regard. We all were experimenting with different ways of attaching yourself to a cliff without your arms wearing out, is the short of it. And what provoked this round of innovation was a practical need itself, a byproduct of a change in custom. So there was a moment. This was now, I confess, a long time ago, 1970, late 1970s, when the code of ethics concerning purity in climbing softened, and what was formerly regarded as cheating, namely employing devices to help you stay attached, was now regarded as acceptable.
Perhaps even desirable, to say
yes.
The
least.
So into this breach, created by a change in community norms, stepped initially a group of innovators in just fitting Eric's model. And I happen to be a minor player in this drama. But it fits your, now finally being able to turn this away from an autobiographical direction in favor of something more general, it fits your model of widely shared open innovation, in which everybody builds on each other's work. Subsequently,
cheap to do, right.
And subsequently appropriated by the firms who begin now manufacturing leashes that are not as good as the originals.
Absolutely, always the case.
Yeah. Now, but to try to preserve some measure of disagreement here, although this is a wonderful model in some circumstances, not always.
Okay, so this is where we have this marvelous disagreement. So I think the thing is that the model of drug development with $800 million and so on for clinical trials only can exist because of IP. And there are other ways to do this now. And various kinds of experiment are going on, like patients like me and so on, and the idea that you can have distributed trials. And there actually are interesting people who are now developing the statistics so that the kinds of things that patients do can form a valid trial. So in other words, the fact that we sit and see a model, and this is just the corner case. Almost everything else can run without patents, thank you very much. The corner case of pharmaceuticals, if we had innovation going on and it was forced by lack of IP, we would find other models, I'm sure. Meanwhile, we are seeing other models emerge from underneath because drug companies will only supply for major markets. They won't, you know, they won't do clinical trials for things that are not on patent and so on. The whole system is... Anyway, have I ranted enough?
You've done very well. You've painted yourself truly as the radical with that last statement.
It's so funny. And here I am at a business school. Yeah, right.
anyway, you can come to law school anytime to be so radical. Yeah.
So anyway.
A last word on that score? No. Great. So I do want to talk about the form of the book for a few minutes before reception. But are there comments or ideas on the substance that we might spread among us as discussants?
I think you should cold call Mark Wu in the front row.
I would love to call. Okay, Professor Wu, so cold called.
Well, thank you.
You were wearing a tie when you were teaching earlier in Austin.
I thought I would be a little bit more open.
Very cool. That's right.
So, the honest truth is, I actually have to apologize. I have a flight to catch in 2 hours. So, I had to change into something more comfortable for my flight, but I didn't want to miss this. And I think anything that pushes towards a more open and flexible notion of intellectual property is always to be welcome because, as you point out, the right strategy depends very much on the context, and that context is very much dependent on the norms of the users of that community as well as the consumers. And so as I'm sitting here listening to this, what runs through my head is I think we have two narratives that are going on. One, the narrative that we're all discussing. And yet, the second is this narrative of globalization, and perhaps it's almost a cost of globalization narrative, whereby governments are still see certain countries as possessing, just as corporations do, right, see them possessing a competitive advantage in innovation, and believing that closed is more advantageous than open, and we all know that that's true in some contexts and not true in others, as we've discussed. But more so than that, a desire to reap a set of economic rents for their own citizens at the expense of the world writ large. And that tension is leading to some of the reinforcement of the old norms of almost exporting in closed or confined IP regime, and yet running against a world writ large that is revolting, particularly in the developing world, towards this, but yet doesn't have the power dynamics to really fight back against that. And I think that's a tension that, as I hear your story, I think and process about. And what I wonder is what role CEOs and businesses reading all of this have to play, because they are oftentimes the power players in shaping the dynamics of this globalization. And anything that helps to sort of bring a greater sense of discourse to this is to be welcome. Where did we wind up with this? I still think is a battle between these two types of tensions, and Americans especially welcoming globalization on the one hand, but being outraged when the Chinese are stealing things that, on the other hand, you think perhaps should be open, right?
That's a wonderful invocation. I wonder if I might parlay that actually into a cold call on another professor here, Juan Carlos de Martin, our great friend from Torino, plainly one of the experts on thinking about this in a global context. Juan Carlos, I don't know if you would be willing to say a few words by way of response, obviously not the developing country context, but more of the international context from the Europe perspective.
Well, one thing that I was thinking while you were presenting the book and hearing the comments was that every time that is underlined the spectrum of possibilities that intellectual property presents, we are doing something sensible. But at the same time, we're also reminding people that the default can be challenged, the default that everything has to be all rights reserved. And challenging the default, I think it's important also for when we discuss policy, because it opens minds. It opens the possibility that other regime can be possible and that modifications to the current system can be made.
That's wonderful. Thank you. So last call for a general comment, and then we'll switch to the forum issue. Without cold calls, we get nothing around here. It's all right. All right, so on the forum topic for a few minutes. One of the things that I wanted to do in this book was, from the start, to think about the book more broadly than just like this. So as Terry suggested, there is this forum, and you can take it and read it as you would any other book. But we thought about it from the start, and by we, I mean my great friend and colleague June Casey from the library, who's been a complete, complete wonder throughout this process, and many others in the Berkman context who have helped. Where we've thought about it also as something that belongs on the web in a broad sense, and this is the sort of medium case. So if you go on the MIT Press site, there are some versions of the book that you can get to. Not the whole thing yet, although we could talk about that at some point, but the series of case studies that are appended to this book are found online. So the idea would be, if you're interested in the smartphone example, which is covered in a few pages of the book, you can find the longer form 10-page version of this. So we've thought about it sort of as a hypertext link, right? You're reading along, and there are a few paragraphs about smartphones, and you click on it, and you get the 10-page version in that sense. So you can't do it quite like this, but you can do it in this context. Collegiate licensing is one example where we make the case from the perspective of a university how you might think about licensing your brand, for instance. And with the help of students here, we've developed a bunch of case studies. So that's one way in which the book is expansive, and there's additional material. A second way in which it's expansive is that I realize that I don't have the corner on wisdom here, and I need friends to help. So one of the things we've done on the MIT Press site as well is to put a series of videos. A series of videos that I hope will grow. If anybody wants to be interviewed on this score, I'd be delighted to interview you and put it on this site. Here's our friend Yochai, who is not here, but I thought we would channel him briefly in the way that that Larry did, and you can see a 25-minute version.
Hello, I'm John Hoffman, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Yochai Benker. Thank you so much for spending time with me this morning.
It's a pleasure to get a chance to talk.
It's a show for me. So the basic topic I want to take up is the issue of intellectual property strategy. And in light of what you wrote in The Wealth of Networks, and in your famous paper before that, which was Penguin, and otherwise, you've made a case that the nature of production is changing, the way in which markets are changing, and one of the things that I've been trying to explore is how the range of options for CEO or the head of an institution is changing. I wonder what guidance, in a general sense, not legal advice, but kind of general strategic guidance, you would give a CEO or a institutional leader at this point in history in terms of their intellectual property strategy and how the range of options may have changed since decades ago.
So I think the first thing to recognize is that exclusive closed IP strategies are the exception, not the rule, not only contemporary, but along very long periods. We've got series of survey studies going back to the early 80s, surveying wide ranges of industry, which suggests that firms have a much broader range of strategies. The reason that we hear so much about IP is that those industry segments, pharmaceuticals, some medical tools, Hollywood, recording industry, where it is central to their strategy, it's really central to their strategy. That's it.
So I could listen to Yokai all day, as I think we all could, but you get the point, which is Yokai can't be here, but he can be here, right, in the sense of the book. And he's wonderful. It's amazingly hard to see yourself on video, by the way. That's horrible to watch. I wasn't anticipating that. Okay, so version number one of the book is like this. And I take the Kindle version that you can buy to be roughly this. We've just transported sort of a PDF and stuck it on a Kindle. It's not really an innovation other than it's more portable, right, in that way. Version number two is trying to figure out how you can have, roughly speaking, hypertext links from the argument into supplemental materials. And I think that's been done in various ways, but I think there are versions here that have interest. The third version that we want to show you is the one that is the most inventive. I don't know, Aaron, if you want to come up and we can get set up on the switch. But the idea was to, from the start, to think about this book as presenting itself as an application that might run, say, on an iPad or an Android device and otherwise. So the idea was to have roughly the same material and the same set of arguments, but the ability to link out to the open web, the ability to embed those videos within the context of an application, to have more interesting ways through the work, pathways that are different, choose your own adventure and so forth, that would allow you to think about the process of reading and experiencing a book as literally pressing down on your iPad and downloading an application and then having this embedded thing that links out into the world come up on your device. So amazingly enough, our friends at the MIT Press, Ellen Farron I see here, and Margie and Jake Furbush and others have agreed to work toward having an iPad app version of this book, quite distinct from this one. And Aaron, amazing developer and graduate of the MIT Media Lab, has been doing this coding and lots of work from June and others, and I'm excited to have him show off the beta version or alpha version of our app, which is hopefully...
not a Google beta that lasts about 5 or 6 years.
Right. We'll see.
Thank you so much. So it's been pretty fun actually developing this app and trying to rethink about how can we think about the unique digital affordances of an iPad.
Talked about how machines could essentially be used to augment scientific research by compiling these giant libraries that a lot of people now see as kind of early predictions of the web. And the web has certainly made a big stride into this. But when we think about the form of a book, this is really deep knowledge. But the traditional form of a book, when we put it into an electronic form, such as the Kindle, doesn't really seem to have changed much. And it's not really taking advantage of the unique opportunities to be able to branch off and let the user have a lot more control about the information that they're seeing, as well as pulling a lot of additional information as well, as Professor Palfrey's talked about. So in a lot of ways, this is just like any other normal ebook where we can kind of go through and swipe along. But what we also have is integrated into this a series of these links that you can, on your own, choose to read more. So for example, the case studies that we were just mentioned that were online, we have now inline into the text. And so they're presented at key points where the authors thought that this is a good point for you to go ahead and read that case study. And so we can go to these case studies, read through them. There are only a couple pages each. And then go back to exactly where we were and continue our original reading. What's also nice that we have, again, is these videos, right? Just like, oh, we don't seem to be on the internet. Okay, well, having Wi-Fi issues, apparently. But as you can imagine, the video starts to play in line, and you're able to look at it into the book itself. What's also really nice, in addition to these videos, is that we've taken certain terms in the book that we think may be unfamiliar to certain kinds of audiences, given the fact that especially this book has a wide variety of types of people who would read it. So for somebody like me from a tech background, I may not know much about patents versus copyright, but an attorney may not be familiar with terms like patent troll. And so these special terms are highlighted and present an opportunity for the viewer to simply click on it, see an actual description of the term, and if they want, they can go to the glossary itself, read the patent troll and all the other things in the glossary, and then go back. Again, footnotes work exactly the same way. And then the final little bit that we've got in the book is outside web resources as well. So it's not just these case studies that Professor Paul Freeves authored, but it's also, which I'm not going to be able to do because we don't have Wi-Fi right now, it would normally pull up a web page where, in this case, it would be going to the U.S. Patent Office. So that is the current version that you're seeing. To continue on this line of what is the digital affordance, we've been thinking about taking this and putting it into a non-linear form. So right now, this follows a traditional book that we have chapters and kind of a timeline, and everything's organized as the original print book was. But again, a wide variety of audiences may be wanting to read this, and they would have different types of background knowledge. And so what we can do is take said these prototypes, such as the developer or the CEO of a major Fortune 500 company, and craft together not only elements from this book that they should read, but perhaps outside knowledge that they may also want to know ahead of time before they can fully appreciate the content of the book itself. So that choose your own adventure style is also something that's in development. So that's basically it. Oh, yeah, that's right. And we have one special little feature for those who RSVP'd and were able to get the iPad app ahead of time, the current beta, we're going to have a signing for it. And so I guess we're going to demo the secret signing right now, which you can't do, by the way, on a Kindle.
So let's see if this works. So Aaron Zinman and his the team that has included June Casey and many others have done an unbelievable amount of work on this. It's very hard to have done. It also has not yet been approved as an app at Apple. Various other hurdles stand between here and innovation. We'll see if we do get approved eventually. I have to get some help. But I did want to open it up broadly for discussion about the format of the book and the future of the book in light of this. This is obviously one baby step towards something different. But yes, sir. The app is nothing yet. It's a beta, but yes, sir. Andy, do you want to press the button?
So how can you incorporate comments and annotations in some kind of reasonable way so, you know, avoid spam and so forth?
I think I'm going to turn to the developers in this context. Is there a way to incorporate comments in the context of this this affordance?
Right now, that is not part of what was being estimated to be built. Certainly, one could imagine several type features where people
right now, we're just trying to stick with the original author's content.
I would love it, though. I think from an author's perspective, do you mind actually pressing again?
Oh.
From an author's perspective, I would love an open source app, and I would love one that could be have commentary within it. One question is whether or not the commentary belongs within the app itself, which has particular qualities to it, right? Or does the commentary belong outside? So if you have downloaded an app on day one and a bunch of comments happen in the meantime, do we have the comments reside somewhere elsewhere that someone would then simply click out to externally, or is it something that we would expect people continuously to be downloading the app in order to get them? I think there are lots of questions as to how that would work, but it seems to me that's it would be a great design question to take up.
Have you thought of any way of like letting users sort of build on top of the app in terms of, you know, trying to present the book in different ways? Like one example I can think of is perhaps users might be interested in sort of speed reading. There's a trivial example. There are some speed reading programs that would flash words like 1 second at a time individually, stuff like that. There could be, you know, infinitely generative type of things that you could build on a book like this, and I wonder if you've given any thought to something like that.
I haven't, but I'd love it. Again, I think that's another example where we should crowdsource these ideas and figure out a way to make that possible. I see no reason why that wouldn't be a generally good thing for knowledge and for this book in particular as well. How about any librarians or publishers who have a view on the future of the book? And am I doing something that is contrary to what a librarian ought to be focusing on in this this moment in history?
I don't think you're doing anything contrary at all, but it does raise some interesting questions. So if you acquire the app, what do you get with it? Do you get the package that has all the videos forever, or do you get just links that may work, may not work, depending on whether the server is still supported, et cetera, et cetera? So that's one of the things that librarians are always thinking about for what content they're acquiring access to versus, you know, having forever.
I think it's a particularly good question for here in the Berkman community, because one of our colleagues, Jeffrey Schnapp, has been developing Extramuros, which you've seen. This is a digital curation platform, and one of the things that it does is it points to lots of other stuff. Does anybody here from the Extramuros team? And I know that very often librarians look at it and say that's a completely wonderful thing and it's completely terrifying because we're afraid that this will be a wonderful curation thing for a period of time, but then the links break and then sort of the value of it is broken down. And I'm not positive that there's an obvious answer to that. John?
Tying together the substantive part of this evening with the format of the book part, can you share what must have been a somewhat meta and self-conscious exercise in figuring out the intellectual property strategy for your book on intellectual property strategy?
Sure. So my strategy is to develop as many forms as possible and make them as widely available as possible. That doesn't always mesh with the realities of the publishing industry, and I know Ellen Farron has just put on her light, so I'm going to let her go next. This is a context in which, as you and I know, we've developed several books with MIT Press which are freely available on the web. This one now is not. It's constrained in various ways, although there's lots of it that you can get accessible. So I would, as an author, love to be in a position to free it up entirely, but there are real constraints that a publisher faces when you come to them to put it into this format. So my own strategy is one of as open as possible over time, but it's also instructive of the realities of the marketplace as it stands right now, that may be in tension with the with others in the ecosystem. Ellen?
So I'm Ellen Farron, director of the MIT Press, proud publisher of the book that we're celebrating. I just want to add two things. One is that I have developed a guiding principle, which is no gratuitous multimedia. I think there's a danger in this whole part of the world of putting features in and stuff because you can. And so I think it's important to sort of stay with what your reader actually is going to appreciate. The other is that another direction that we're exploring that is exciting, I think, is what about digital works collected together with features like a taxonomy for the field developed by its own community and that sort of thing. And that would be beyond this individual title app thing, but we're exploring that. Larger digital communities that have input from the community.
Andy, go ahead.
I thought I'd say something because I work for O'Reilly, so I thought maybe I could give a publisher's perspective. So I'll say two things, one directed to Ellen about the advantages of having comments, annotations, and donations, although I do think they should be curated. But the advantage is that you preclude anybody else producing a competing book, because why would they bother producing a competing book when they can just add, especially if it's open content? And on another side, I'm getting excited about this because I think about people adding more and more. This is a very important topic that is becoming an important social movement. So when does this stop being a book and stop being an app and start being a movement?
I think That's a wonderful kind of last word to leave it on. And I commend O'Reilly's work in this area enormously. You guys have been, you know, pushing the envelope of what a book is and what an app is now for some time. And I commend hugely our friends at MIT Press who have been very, very broad-minded about this project and excited to work with us on it. I'm deeply grateful to Margie Avery, the editor on this, and to Ellen for jumping in, and Aaron Zinman, of course, for all this development. So thank you. I think the last word goes to Professor Zitron, which I'm slightly worried about as well. But it'll be funny anyway.
Is that just on general principles, or is there something specifically worrying you?
Rather more specific principles, but go ahead.
Well, that's funny, because it's affecting what I'm going to say.
The Heisenberg principle.
Yeah. Well, this evening, this event, has a wonderfully kind of familial feel to it. Because, John, we're all just so happy for what you've produced here and how representative it is of all of your work and the signature in particular. So now Larry's being the one that's kind of, yes. But that the book and the rest of your work and your relationships with colleagues, with strangers, with students, et cetera, it just, you are so fleet and you make it look so effortless, and you're so damn good at it, and just have so much energy, and all of the things that come together for leadership. So all of this made me think, particularly in light of the fact that you will be leaving us in some way at the end of the year, we all thought actually it might be fitting to begin the laborious and soon to be awkward process of saying goodbye to you in a way that really tries to recognize those very qualities that I was just describing, and simultaneously recognizing that you're going to a prep school. And that concept has had a lot of play in the media lately, too. So all of that leads us to present you in a way that reminds me, too, of trademark infringement as yet another aspect of intellectual property, with this golden snitch as, because I understand that the Andover Kittich team is really good and give those Brits a run for their money. Yeah.
He's the assistant coach of the Kittich team.
Very good. But from all of us at the Berkman Center, at the library, at Harvard, and even the greater community, I dare to speak on behalf of, we just wanted to give you this as a token of just, you know, how good you are with that broomstick and how fun it is to watch you do what you do.
Thank you. I will treasure this always, but first one ever. So thank you all for coming very much, and I hope you'll join us for a reception just outside.